Okay. Thanks again, everyone, for downloading this next episode of the podcast. I'm quite happy that we got the next episode out quite quickly after Will Zing from Rigetti came on to talk to us about what's going on there. And today we have another conversation with a newly formed quantum computing startup, namely Michael and Michael from QControl, which is a startup that's based in Sydney focusing on software platforms in order to control and reliably make qubits do what they're supposed to do. So guys, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thank you for letting us join you. Yeah.
So Michael, you're the CEO and the founder of QControl, and you've done a podcast with me before ostensibly talking about your Iron Trap platform. So give us a bit of an outline of what this effort is, what you guys are doing, and really what made you do this.
Yeah, I mean, QControl is a new organization that's based on a lot of the work that the academic team has done over the last 8 years. That is, our focus has traditionally been on devising techniques to make quantum systems, like qubits in particular, do useful things. And we focused on a variety of ways to approach that, from what's called dynamic error suppression, these so-called open-loop measurement-free strategies like dynamic decoupling to improve the fidelity of quantum memory, through to approaches like Kalman filtering, things that are well known in the classical engineering literature, but have some tweaks that are required if we want to apply them in the quantum domain. You know, we're inspired a lot by the development of aviation, where there was an industry that really did exist at the time the Wright brothers had their big success. That industry was at the time trying to achieve something called inherent stability, making an aircraft that flew no matter what the pilot did. And the Wright brothers, who were successful in achieving the first manned, powered, controlled flight, really took a different approach. They said, well, stability is great, but what if we give the pilot more control? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they were successful in achieving this tremendous feat, and they informed the entire, what is now aerospace industry. Every time you're on an aircraft, you're flying based on the concepts of control that they introduced. QControl is looking to do similar things in the quantum domain, leveraging our academic experience and now building products for not just the research community, but also the emerging commercial sector in quantum technology, quantum computing. So the big names that you would think of are our potential market, but also defense and aerospace, even health and medicine, where some of the control techniques we've developed are valuable in developing next generation MRI sequencing and the like.
So this is not really the sort of concepts that we've talked a lot about on the podcast with various guests, sort of this active large-scale thing that we call quantum error correction. This is more in line with what I would call quantum error suppression, being able to control systems cleaner, doing some more complicated things, basically to make your fidelities higher and hopefully eliminate some of the needs, at least in the quantum computing space, for these expansive and highly resource unfriendly error correction protocols.
Yeah, that's right. Our solutions come in kind of two different ways. One is in the nearer term, noisy intermediate scale quantum computers, like John Preskill has termed them, where we can suppress errors to levels that make smaller hardware systems, maybe hundreds or thousands of qubits, useful. But then in the long term, by both reducing errors and changing the correlations between errors, which is a new result that's coming out of our academic team, we're able to improve the efficiency of quantum error correction that we think is necessary for very big machines.
So in the case of what you've done so far, this has all come out of the Iron Trap research primarily that you were doing here at Sydney and your experience with trying to implement some of these theoretical protocols.
Well, so, you know, the nature of our lab is that we focus on quantum control techniques, not ion trap experiments per se. So we really try to develop things that are technology agnostic, and we work with trapped ions because they're this exceptionally clean, very well controlled system. Our efforts have also been validated by our collaborations with, say, MIT, with Will Oliver, where very similar techniques are demonstrated in superconducting qubits. So the solutions that QControl provides that the other Michael will tell you about in a little bit, they are not specific to trapped ions. They're not specific to any technology. They are agnostic as long as you have a qubit.
Right, so you should be able to implement them in ion traps, superconductors, possibly quantum dots, silicon, all these others.
We know that quantum dots already use the kind of most rudimentary forms of these kinds of control. They need them because the decoherence mechanisms are quite strong there.
So give me a bit of a motivation as to why you pulled this out as a separate company. Why have you joined this sort of startup club that's now sort of burgeoning around the world?
Well, I mean, the nature of what one does in a commercial organization is just different than what one does in an academic setting. In academia, our goal is to kind of discover the truth, right? To learn new things about the way the world works, maybe answer technical problems. Of course, we do things that are applied as well as fundamental, but certainly you don't get any funding whatsoever to build products.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our objective is to provide solutions to others in their in the community, a community of hardware developers, the community of researchers and scientists and all these other application spaces. You can't get support to do that in academia. So the company, QControl, was founded with the idea that by having this non-academic entity, and the university has no relationship to it at all in a legal sense, we're able to build things, we're able to hire a technical team that Michael leads, and mm-hmm. we're also able to hire a product team, professional developers to build things that are useful for our customers.
So,
I was just going to say the other great thing, like there are so many other constraints involved in doing research, but if you actually want to make a product, there's actually lots and lots of boring stuff to do,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing, like it's harder to kind of do the kind of boring, unoriginal but necessary things to make a really great product, which will work every time and people will want to use. And so I think it's just been a really great opportunity to kind of, by moving into this space of like a company making a product to sell, we can actually have a lot of people focusing on those things, which will really help make, I think, these quantum computers a reality faster than necessarily in these labs.
Give us an example, try to make it the cleanest example you can think of what one of these software products might end up being. Let's put it in the context of quantum computing,
mm-hmm.
of qubit control. What are you looking to develop, and how do you think it's going to end up helping hardware vendors across a multitude of technologies?
Yeah, so I think at the moment, a lot of the kind of control techniques and approaches that people are using are relatively rudimentary. And so what we're providing is a product which someone can go in, look at the particular configuration they have, which is whether it's ions or superconducting qubits or whatever. They can kind of instantly, immediately put in what they're working with, and then we can show them with a little bit of extra engineering and a little bit more finer control over how they're working with their qubits, the kind of improvements to fidelities that they can see. So the first thing is we're really just that the product will hopefully like educate people on precisely how to do these controls and how they will benefit you in what ways. And then it will just make it, after they've like been convinced of it, this is going to help them, we'll elect basically provide them with a control solution so they can plug directly into their system. And they'll just kick in and hopefully improve the fidelity of the gates that they're trying to do. And also potentially this fooled up scaled full quantum computing operations.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting addition that I wanted to make that comes back to your earlier questions. You know, we obviously, as a team doing complicated experiments on quantum control, we developed a huge amount of code to run our mm-hmm. experiments, to do back-end simulations, to inform us how to do experiments. And in the past, we shared some of that code with other expert teams in the community. The challenge, of course, is that it's code run by or built by grad students, which is not necessarily professional. But also, you know, Michael alluded to this, what we do is despite how frequently it's been validated in experiment by us, by all these other teams, it's kind of seen as a black art, and it's considered kind of too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of our software push is to build intuitive front ends, right? Really investing in things that you can invest in as an academic team to make this technology and this knowledge that we've developed accessible to other quantum researchers, but not necessarily people who are specialists in quantum control
mm-hmm.
engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael talked a little bit about some of the functionality. This is based on things that we've developed in my team and in others, some of the work that Michael has done when he was an academic in his very recent past life. But we have a lot of plans in the near term to have kind of fully embedded solutions that give hardware operators the ability to have their systems constantly achieving kind of the best fidelity one can achieve, doing recalibrations automatically, runtime controls.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes totally invisible. This is why we call it firmware, right? That there is code that's running, but to the user, they don't even need to know what's going on. All they know is their qubits perform better than they used to.
So just to clarify, I mean, we've had quite a few people on the podcast before at what I call various levels of the software stack.
Mm-hmm.
We've had people talk from Microsoft and IBM about sort of this top level quantum programming environment, circuit compilation. We've had people talking about error correction compilers and decoding for error correction codes. Your stuff, and correct me if I'm wrong, sort of sits at that very last layer when I sort of say, well, I want to do a bit flip on this qubit, or I want to do a controlled knot between these two qubits. What does that mean in terms of what pulses am I sending to my qubits? How am I structuring the frequencies and the amplitudes and everything else to actually control what they're doing? Yeah. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of, like, in practice, what we're targeting. But there are and potentially really positive benefits that go up that stack as well. Mm-hmm. So if you do a really good job on the lower level, not only are you doing a better job at that particular gate, when carefully done, you can also get positive consequences to the upper level error correction or whatever else is going up on top. So basically, yes, that's where we're targeting, but mm-hmm. I think we're all kind of complementing each other at the same time.
Sure, of course. Yeah. If you make your fidelities better, we don't have to do as much work at the error correction layer.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes this is referred to as the virtual layer in, this paper that many people refer to by Cody Jones, mm-hmm. Layered Architecture for Quantum Computing. It sits above the hardware that actually applies pulses of radiation, microwave or laser or otherwise, by kind of defining what a quantum bit flip or a quantum phase flip should be. How should it be implemented? Well, you can do the simplest thing that we sometimes call a primitive gate, or you can use one of Qcontrol's solutions, which are kind of all experimentally validated and, mm-hmm. and well understood, and it just performed better. That's the objective.
So what kind of, give us a metric for what you guys can achieve if you've got the data available. Pick a system, whatever system. Are we talking, you know, factors of 2? Are we talking factors of 10, factors of 100 increase in fidelity?
So, look, from the lab, we have a paper on the archive right now. This is from the academic team, where we show, factor of 10-ish or 20 improvement in overall error using some of these very base, simple control protocols, but more importantly, a factor of nearly 300 improvement in the reduction in error correlations, which mm-hmm. is a really critical metric if you're talking about error correction, right? Mm-hmm. Reducing error correlations in time is a key element there. So we say sometimes that our controls virtualize the errors, make them compatible with quantum error correction. Lots of experiments have demonstrated factors between 10 and 100 easily, and then if you use optimal control solutions, you can even bump that higher. Mm-hmm.
So how does this impact, say, on another unit of metric that's quite important with quantum computing development, namely gate time? So if I've got a primitive sort of uncontrolled, say, C0 operation between two qubits and I implement one of these protocols, how much penalty am I paying in terms of fundamental gate times?
It's a complicated question, but is that really the right metric? Because, I mean, if it takes a bit longer but your fidelity is much higher, then in principle you can last longer anyway. So
play off one another in the fact that yes, you use less error correction, so your logic gates are going to be faster, but if your primitive gates are longer, one's going to extend it, one's going to shrink it, and the question is who wins overall.
And I think but if you're talking about like the total fidelity of the operation, that's the metric of who wins overall, right? This is a really irritating conversation, right? Because you have to get really into the details. But like I'd say if you're doing a short gate really badly, you're better off doing a slightly longer gate at a much higher quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the real thing you care about is, well, there's a lot to talk about there.
Oh, yeah. But it's not a simple question,
yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, it's sort of the number, I think it's the quality per gate which you should really be looking at, because mm-hmm. you want to do the most number of gates while retaining the highest quality. That's your target. And I think people at the moment, if you had a working computer quantum computer that took an hour versus a not working computer that took a second,
mm-hmm.
that would be, you want the working quantum computer in an hour. But this is a hypothetical conversation as well, unfortunately.
Michael is right in that this is exactly the kind of thing that, say, IBM wants to characterize by quantum volume as opposed to a really stripped down metric.
Yeah.
I can give maybe a more concrete answer that generally you have factors of order unity increases in duration
mm-hmm.
for yeah. factors of orders of magnitude improvement in fidelity or memory, right? So mm-hmm. so it is a net win, but
yep.
of course yeah. not, there is no free lunch. It does take longer, your clock rate goes down somewhat, but it's not as bad as it could be in principle. It's certainly not as bad as an error correction.
That's for sure. I imagine it would be a net win overall.
Yeah.
So at this point, Qcontrol's what, about 6 months old now?
Not even. We were funded in November of 2017, and I mean, the deal was really completed in the beginning of December of 2017. The team started in earnest around January 15th. I think that was Michael's first day. So I made some hires right at the end of the year. We appointed Michael as one of the earliest employees, someone I had been targeting for a long time but couldn't because the money wasn't in hand yet. And also Robert Love as CTO, who leads the product development side, and everybody really started going. It's 2 months ago.
So how large is the team now in total?
There's 9 of us, I think, at the moment, but we're hiring at the moment. Yeah, so
with a couple of contractors as well. So I mean, it's around 8 to 10 full-time equivalents. Yeah. And we are hiring a few people as well.
So you talked a little bit about it. It's not only developing, sort of the quantum side of everything, developing the techniques and developing the code, but it's also productizing all of this.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining you're looking at both sides of the equation in terms of people that you hire, experts from the quantum mechanics side and experts in, professional code development, in packaging, marketing, all that kind of stuff in order to push this stuff out there.
Yeah.
What's sort of the balance of resources that you put on one side versus the other? I mean, do you have to actively sell to clients at the moment, or have you struck partnership deals? Is there behind the scenes talk? How does the engagement with the community work so far, considering it's so new?
Okay, I mean, there's a couple of things to unpack there. One is the balance of how we resource the product development versus the quantum control engineering side. It's about 50-50 right now. So Michael leads a team of, including him, 5 people. Mm-hmm. And then we have, about 5 people on the product side as well. Nobody gets to just do fun things that they enjoy. There's always a product focus. We hope everybody enjoys what they're doing, of course. But it's not for pure academic amusement. It's product focused. Nonetheless, I mean, Michael can tell you about this on his own. There are research projects as well as productizing tasks associated with things we already know. In terms of business development is largely my responsibility as the CEO, and we do have some very big partnerships that will be announced soon. Mm-hmm. So watch this space. It's an exciting time for the kinds of things we're trying to do. We're getting very good traction in terms of organizations that are really interested in seeing how we can help them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Michael, in terms of your responsibility, you're very much a quantum guy.
I am a quantum guy, and my history is very quantum. But I think that's really interesting about these companies is that ultimately everyone on the team is focusing on product. But the new part is that in the past there never was anyone who in the history of the world who was a quantum expert and making a product.
Yeah.
So really what's going on is there's just half the team, we need this quantum expertise, and all of us are kind of coming up to speed on how that is best provided to someone in a product context, I guess. So every single person on the quantum team is still working towards product, but we are also answering questions, which research questions, I guess, so to speak, of whether this technique will actually help in reality, what is the most useful thing to deliver first. So we're doing interesting kind of research projects, but all in the context of delivering something which is useful for our customers.
So how much fundamental research do you do on this? Is it sort of collating a lot of work that's being done in this space, whether it's vast array of papers in decoupling sequences and stuff like that? Is it just sort of collating them, finding out what works best in what situation? Or are you also sitting down and saying, there are key aspects that have not been invented yet, and we're going to also do that?
We are filling in gaps more than I was expecting. So that's been a bit interesting. We are basing our research on we're basing what we're delivering primarily on tried and true research that's been delivered. But what's also, there's actually a lot of gaps because research is done one paper at a time, and it's not necessarily done thinking of a huge framework in which it's a part of.
They're also terrible at the details.
Yes.
Hey now.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we are, it's interesting that even when we're delivering what I consider things which are tried and true, we're still coming up with a framework and a logical way and an easy way to interpret all these results and handle it in a single kind of logical manner. Mm-hmm. And that actually requires a lot of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to me also because, you know, we have all this physics that's been validated, and we have toolkits that are validated, things like this filter transfer function framework that we've relied on and developed a lot over the last few years. But as Michael says, we have developed them for certain applications and instances. Mm-hmm. We know they're more generic because we've seen them applied in other ways. Mm-hmm. But how do you build an algorithm on the back end that can be applied by anybody for their system, right? That's a different question than does the physics work in all these cases. We know that's true, but now Michael has been, you know, taking this task of making viable products, which of course involves a huge amount of algorithmic development. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, talking to Robert, who leads the product team, you know, it was a bit of discovery for the professional software engineers to see how much algorithmic development needs to be done in order to take these validated physical concepts into products.
Yeah. And we're also defining a new language. I think that's the other interesting thing, because like in the research community, everyone speaks their own little particular terminology or niche way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And what's been a lot of what's been going on, which has been really good actually, having us quantum guys exposed to product people, is that like you really have to define a unified logical language to talk about all these techniques, and that's been an interesting and like ongoing process as well. We're trying to just come up with the language to cover all the techniques we're developing. Yeah, it's not as simple as it seems.
No.
It's like, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting also because it's not just the way we speak about things; it's the way we actually implement things, right?
Yeah.
As an ion trap group, we would focus on the physical implementation of, say, the Malmer-Sorensen two-qubit gate. If you're a superconducting experiment, you might do a cross-resonance gate at IBM or this parametrically driven gate at Rigetti. Ultimately, they're all two-qubit gates.
Yep.
But every little pocket of the community focuses on what are the knobs that I have, what are the parameters that make my gate bad or broken. We obviously think about how you can build solutions that can be kind of tailored to the specific needs of a hardware platform. But you want that to all be in an algorithmic framework that is generic. And I don't mean like CNOT, where you draw a CNOT on the board. I mean like from a physical Hamiltonian perspective, making sure all these things are mm-hmm. compatible, coded algorithmically in a way that's compatible across all of them, but then can be used to deploy hardware-specific solutions that work for each one of those. Just getting that built has been a really interesting and exciting challenge.
Yeah.
So how do you interface with different systems? Do you really have to start developing from the ground up when you talk to a superconducting guy or an ion trap guy or a quantum dot guy and say, okay, we've got to build in your Hamiltonian structures, your decoherence models, everything like that? Or do you believe that there is some sort of global package that can be built on top that's been tweaked?
Yeah, so I think what we're working, there's sort of two halves to it, but we are making a kind of a global package which can be tweaked for anyone. But the challenge then is really to bring someone in, and the product should make it as easy as possible for superconducting, for ions, for anyone to come in and use that global structure. So you kind of have to do both. But I really do believe that we are building a proper workhorse underneath it all, which covers everything. And I guess that's the challenge, is like we're trying to define this. Inside, we're defining the language and the numerical core of like this generic thing to cover control for all these companies. But then we are also providing like an interface layer for anyone who's using it. So you have to do both,
mm-hmm.
and it's really challenging to cover everything, I guess.
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit like, you know, a lot of mobile phones run Android, and then a particular manufacturer puts their own skin on it, right, in order to make it look the way they want or behave the way they want. We're kind of in the position where, as we grow the business, we're both building the back end, we're building the equivalent of Android, and we're building the skin for a particular user to show them how this back end computational tool can give solutions specifically for their needs. And what we will do as their products mature is have more and more of these kind of skin options available on the front end, so people can say, well, okay, I'm doing superconducting qubits, this is the kind of gate I want, and all the relevant knobs that are appropriate for their hardware platform are built into the system, but all the computations are done with this framework, this algorithmic framework that we are developing and that's validated by experiments in my lab and in other labs.
So I imagine as you guys start to expand, as you start working with these other partners, you're actually going to have to sit down, you know, in Martinez's lab at Google or Jerry's lab at IBM or Chad's lab at Rigetti and literally work in the labs with them and say, okay, what knobs am I turning and then how do I do this? Or do you think it can be a much more remote thing?
I think we will. It's a bit of both, but we will definitely need to visit and consult with them. We will consult with all of our customers and figure out how to best address them. Mm-hmm. But this is a lot to do. This is why thinking about things in terms of product is really helpful, because there's actually a very robust and complete way to approach product where you can consult with lots of people and figure out how to best deliver these things to them. This is not a new problem for us. That's an established and a very normal thing to do, right? For companies to go and chat with people with lots of different needs and figure out how to best provide that to them in the product. So we will be consulting with all of our customers, and that may involve visits. That may involve some things offsite.
How has it been trying to develop these relationships? Because at the moment, because quantum technology and these quantum computing companies are so new, they do a lot in house. Because it's all still, you know, hacking together things and putting together things.
Yeah, I think there's two things to say. One is, yes, these big organizations and some of the smaller ones as well, they have a huge amount of technical expertise, but one can't be an expert in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what typically gets dropped, the kinds of things in control engineering that are a little bit more out there in terms of uptake or application, those are the things that get dropped first, because people, you know, if you're building superconducting qubits, well, you need people at the fab, you need people who are getting the fridges running, you need people who are running the 2-qubit gates and programming the microwave generators. The idea of having a dedicated control engineering team has not been has not had the uptake that would be required to build the solutions in a robust way, and that's exactly where we enter in, because we offset the need to make that kind of investment. But from the kind of biz dev side, it's still, despite the growth, a small community, and we have professional relationships with many organizations around the world, both via collaborations and, you know, I used to be a funding agent at Department of Defense in the United States, so we used to fund some of these people. I think that network and the network that Michael brings, that actually has much more contact with the proper engineering community and machine learning community, he's an ML expert that comes into our product framework, that is how we demonstrate our value to customers. And so far the traction has been exceptionally good.
So at the moment you're obviously developing the software solutions themselves, but this might be a bit premature to ask this kind of question, but when you imagine these things scaling up, when you imagine these systems getting larger and larger, whether it's communications, computation, whatever, is there a point where you guys think, well, we're going to actually have to get into the hardware a little bit, because many of these things are not going to be like a physics lab where we've got a dill fridge or a vacuum system. It comes out to these big rack of computers that we can just program with something that's working well, but maybe slow, classically slow, I mean. Have you had these kind of discussions yet as to whether ultimately, you know, these solutions are going to have to be custom silicon on chip sitting right next to the computers? Or is that a far too premature question at this point?
I mean, I have some views on this. I mean, the first is, it is not in our plans at all for the foreseeable future to be building hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Every organization, every lab has their own hardware control solution. And certainly as, you know, bigger teams mature in their technology, they'll become more capable in what they build and what they deploy, but also more entrenched. And my view as an ion trap experimentalist on the academic side has been that it has been an extraordinarily vexing issue to try and homogenize control hardware. And rather than that, we can look at what's common. And what's common is that everybody is at some level controlling their hardware platform with a programmable logic device, FPGA. And so for our embedded solutions, the product, by the way, is called Boulder Opal, in this Opal-themed framework of all of our products. In Boulder Opal, the idea is to run a very small amount of microcode that sits locally on the controller, either on a soft core or by dedicated VHDL that the team implements. And then all the computational stuff is in the cloud, right? It makes sense because everybody is looking at cloud-based solutions in terms of selling access to their quantum computer for the medium or long term. It makes sense that these are internet-connected machines, and so the solutions for the computations can also be internet-based, you know, cloud-based computations. You can look at it the way people build DRAM, right? There are people who are manufacturers of this highly commoditized product, and my understanding is it's not a very good business. And then there are the people who sell the control solutions called DRAM Refresh that make DRAM work. Right, it's why it's $2.50 per gigabyte to manufacture, because it's a control solution that in spirit is similar to what we deploy. I think you can separate the building things from, you know, crafting control and software solutions. Michael, maybe you have a different view in the longer term, but certainly from a business perspective, it is not you know, it is not the right time to be thinking that you can deploy a solution that will be dropping for everybody in terms of hardware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the key comment, that last part, that we really want to be a solution which is available to everyone. Like, and by going to hardware, there's a risk of making ourselves more specific, but we want to, we obviously want to make it as easy as possible for everyone to use our software, but not at the trade-off of like losing a huge part of the market. So I think that it depends on precisely what you mean, but hardware to me sounds like overly targeting a very specific niche. And we just don't know who's going to win the quantum race, and we want to be there for the long quantum race. You know what I mean? So
I suppose my question
that will work for everybody.
Yeah, I suppose my question was more related. Maybe it's more related to the nature of how these things work. Is from what Mike you said, it seems to be a pre-compilation step. That you can feed something into the cloud before you switch on your computer, feed in all the necessary information, generate these pulse sequences in order to increase fidelity, and away you go. Versus something that might be more dynamic. As the computer is running, it is taking information that's coming out of, say, error correction protocol, something like that, rejigging the control sequences on the fly, and then feeding it back into the machine.
Yeah, well, it's actually both, right? So part of the product offering in the first cloud-based platform, which is called Black Opal, is really focused on pre-compiled solutions, right? You can either optimize a solution based on noise in your hardware that we can help you characterize and get data on the spectrum of it, and then you can come up with solutions that then you implement on your hardware. That's certainly part of the offering, but especially for the embedded packages like Boulder Opal, the idea is to have runtime controls where you do runtime optimization and runtime calibration. Now, that doesn't mean at all times the machine is pinging the server and trying to get new things, but it does mean on some schedule you recalibrate, on some schedule you re-optimize, because we know that all of these platforms are highly susceptible to drift. We see it in my academic lab as well. Things change over a course of 6 or 12 hours, even though we have a very stable lab. The idea will be that the software solutions we're providing are always integrated and always somehow re-optimizing. It's just not done, you know, continuously at all times.
Do you foresee that that can be something that can be, say you've got a long computation that's being run on a large-scale machine sometime in the distant future, do you foresee that as something that can be done, this recalibration or re-pinging, can be done during runtime? Or is it more like, say that the IBM machine at the moment, there is a period where the machine goes down, it recalibrates itself, then it comes back up?
Yeah, I think that's more a function of the small size scale. When you're talking about 5 qubits, yeah, if you're going to recalibrate them, they all have to go down. I think if you're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of qubits, the possibility of, you know, doing recalibration on 10 at a time and just taking 10 out of the, that's totally possible.
Yeah.
So at the moment, as you can see from the other players in this space, and yes, most people are not really at this level of the software control. It's much more higher level. There is obviously a bit of a push for open sourcing, for at least, if it's not open source code, then at least giving access to people for free to begin with and play with it. A lot of that's about, I think, jostling for position to become sort of a de facto standard.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's about trying to engage the broader community to help develop these algorithms for small scale quantum computers that don't really exist yet. In terms of your plans for these platforms, is it going to be maybe not open source code, but at least is it going to be sort of this same sort of framework of trying to bring people in by offering this thing to play around with before maybe selling it off?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we're definitely interested in making it easy to use for a certain set of users. So we certainly want to make sure that we continue to be friendly to the academic friends that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it is important that, again, we want to enable research to, you know, accelerate where it can, and we want people to kind of learn our product, understand how it can help them, and hopefully they'll take that into the future when they might move out of the academic setting and maybe into a more commercial setting. But we're still working through these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're still determining what the best approach is. But
yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, there will be a combination of things that on the code side are open and things that are closed, right? Obviously, the front-end interface, which is a lot of our special sauce to make these things accessible and usable, is not all open. That said, you know, in terms of our pricing and business structure, in order to help the research community, it's not just academics, it's everybody who's doing research, you know, that means we give away the product to a lot of people. We make it freely licensed to a lot of people. And the objective is to say, well, when the industry that's emerging now grows to a point where it's self-sustaining and it's earning revenue, that if we're providing solutions that are assisting hardware manufacturers or others to drive revenue, then we should have a license arrangement that gives us a share of that, right? It's a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We help their computers actually function, right? And function in a way that solves useful problems. And when they're doing that and earning revenue based on that, we also earn revenue associated with that. So it will be there will be tiered licenses about what functionality is available in different classes of product. But we do really want, as Michael was saying, not just to accelerate the hardware development, but also to help this community, take advantage of the benefits of this body of literature that is developed over many, many years, and to some degree has been a little bit underutilized. I think there's a long way it can go towards improving performance. The best way to do that is to give it to people so they can improve their hardware.
I imagine that validation is also an important thing, considering nobody really has built software packages based on these principles before.
Well, I mean, look, we've done it in the laboratory at a grad student level, as I said. These are physical principles that are well validated in experiment, and the improvements we get are really significant. Turning that into a product, as we've talked about, that then gets deployed to do useful things on, you know, a client's hardware platform. Yeah, of course, that's part of the service offering that we oversee by interacting with our customers. As we build the products, we also interact with them to ensure that it's working for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I would say that we're going to do a lot of validation ourselves. I think.
Sure.
But I think this is a big difference again with the. As a researcher, often you might put a paper out there and expect it to be checked by someone else. That's a more normal thing to do. But we really want to make a high quality piece of software which is reliable and trustworthy. And so we can invest the kind of time, a lot more time, into making sure that it is all working so that it is great to have other people validate it. But we're pretty confident it's going to work as well as it possibly can.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I mean, we have the benefit that my academic team is right here. And they are beneficiaries of access to the software because it addresses the kinds of things we do on a daily basis, the things we used to do research in, but now we rely on to do new research, perform new research tasks. So that's another kind of validation right here, and obviously with the partnerships that we're developing as well.
Do you see as maybe a spin-off of the kind of work is maybe you get into the business as sort of being, you know, standard bearers or de facto standards or benchmarkers against possible other outfits or or other companies who might end up getting into this space?
Yeah, that's definitely a real potential because, as Mike was saying earlier, we are also providing ways of assessing and characterizing the quality of your system. So, and if everyone is using the same software to do that, there'll be some much more consistency in the actual data that they're working with. So I think there are real opportunities for us to be part of the wider discussion of benchmarking these systems.
Yeah. And I also see it as quite collaborative. I mean, Quantum Benchmark is an example of a smaller startup in Canada that's focused specifically on this task of characterizing the performance of multi-qubit systems. Right. I think we have a role to play as a complement to them because we focus more on the physical device characterization. What is the actual spectrum of noise, and how does that lead to individual gate fidelities or gate errors, as opposed to, you know, how do I efficiently characterize a system with dozens of quantum bits? They're different tasks that relate to each other, and I think as this industry develops, we have a role to play alongside our many partners, alongside nominal competitors, although I actually think the community is much more collaborative at this stage, in kind of building standards and helping the community advance. That's really our objective.
Well, I imagine standards is going to become a very, very prescient topic in the next 5 years when these systems are getting up and running.
Yeah, look, it's been discussed, and at Army Research Office program reviews for the university team, I have frequently spoken of the need to begin planning at organizations like NIST for de facto standard development and testing. And there is this guy Worley in Austin is focused on IEEE standards for quantum technology.
And he's just launched a company as well.
Strangeworks.
Strangeworks.
Yeah. Their algorithm development, the top layer of the stack.
Yeah. Right.
As best I understand.
So we're getting on to 45 minutes, which is basically where I like to cut this thing off. So, but as I do with everyone, I like to open the floor to you guys to promote, to spruik, to let everyone know what's going to happen, what opportunities are available, and anything public that happens to be going on at QControl in the next 6 months.
We'll look forward to our product, which should be launched by the end of the year. And you can sign up online right now, and we'll let you know when it's ready to go.
It's q-ctrlqcontrol.com.
I'll definitely put a link for that at the description of the podcast episode.
Yeah, sign up, and if you're a researcher, if you're doing open research and you intend to publish, product is the license terms will be that it's totally free for you.
Mm-hmm. And we are also hiring, so if you're in software or in quantum, let us know, and we can have a chat.
And just for everyone to know, this is all based out of the... It's not associated with the University of Sydney, but you'll be based at the University of Sydney?
Physically, we have office space in the Sydney Nanoscience Hub, which is this really awesome building that I was involved in designing for the laboratories here and for the research. We're right next to a team from Microsoft, which is very exciting because they have huge expertise, not only in kind of hardware for quantum experimentation, but also ASIC design and all sorts of... interesting classical engineering expertise, radio frequency and microwave. It's a really cool place to get to work. There are so many different parts of the quantum ecosystem, all in a 10 meter radius or something, or 20 meter radius. So if you're interested, get in touch, and we are expanding globally as well, starting next year.
Great. Well, I'll definitely put all the links for it, and I would definitely recommend it if you're interested. University of Sydney is a great place to be, and Sydney in general for quantum computing and that kind of research is also becoming one of the major centres in the world for this kind of research and development.
Yeah.
So, guys, thanks a lot again for sitting down with me for 45 minutes and adding to the list of startups that are on the podcast.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, everyone, for downloading again. As I said, check out our Twitter feed in order to keep up to date with the next upcoming episodes. Hopefully, there'll be a new one every week or two, provided I don't get lazy. So, thanks a lot again.